Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. What's the legacy of Vietnam in South Dakota? How has our cultural and political landscape changed by combat veterans, by the music and art of the time, and by those who raised their voices in opposition to the war? SDPB continues to help you prepare for the landmark documentary series, The Vietnam War. It's a 10-part, 18-hour documentary that premieres on SDPB in September. We're broadcasting live today from the new SDPB Black Hills Bureau. We're inside the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio. Jervis Hiddle lives in Hill City, and he joins me now in the studio. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. It's kind of been a long haul. I didn't even look for it, but here I am.
And well, we hope you'll come back again and again as well. We're going to talk about Vietnam and your opposition to it, but let's start with joining the Marine Corps. And when you were a younger man, that was something that you were drawn to. How come you joined the service in the first place?
I think I knew from the time I was about 13 years old that when I became of age, I would join the Marine Corps. And that's what I did. My father was a professional military man. He was Army, and he didn't like the idea of me going to the Marine Corps. But my two older brothers were Army and Marine Corps. He went through Annapolis and graduated and took his commission in the Marine Corps. I just enlisted. I was the first enlisted man in my immediate family for a long time. And then my younger brother followed me, so that's just the way it was. I had known for a long time, so I just did it. I realized after I got there that nobody is ever ready for boot camp. That's the first important lesson. Nobody is ever ready for boot camp. So
San Diego.
Yeah.
Okay. What were you not ready for specifically?
Oh, anything.
Everything. Yeah.
Well, I anticipated military discipline, things like that, but boot camp is a new ball game.
Right. So this is around the era of the Korean War.
Oh yeah.
What's your experience there?
When I was there, I was mostly in a defensive position above the Imjin River on a place called Hill 495, and mostly it was just defensive. We could watch the people on the other side of the river gather at night and, you know, shoot off flares and trumpets and whistles and shouting and things like that, and everybody shouted back and made a lot of noise going back, but at the same time, you know, everybody's zeroed in on everybody else, so it didn't make any difference. There were all these flares. You could see people down there on the river. It's just the way it was.
When you look at the events in Korea today, does it seem like more of the same to you?
Not exactly. The Chinese had come over in force, and so it was not only North Korea, but it was the Republic of China and the Chinese mainland. There were just untold numbers. I mean, it was incredible to see it at night, and it was incredible. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, we didn't have a lot of activity going on. There was some, but that's the way it was. And then we were replaced by the Army, and our unit came back to the States to Camp Pendleton, California. And I finished out my hitch, and after that I had previously promised my mother, who was the greatest woman in the world, that when I had finished my hitch that I would go to college. And that's what I did. And I got so involved with that, particularly as an undergraduate, I didn't do very much except learn how to study, because all I knew what to do was learn how to be a Marine infantryman. And so I learned how to study and took it on and graduated from the University of Oklahoma and went to, teaching assistantship at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, and did my master's degree there in about one academic year and a summer, started my PhD program and finished that up ultimately in about 1970, I think, I was awarded. And I'd started teaching in South Dakota in 1968, so I did 2 years of working on my dissertation while I was here. And after that, I got a couple of fellowships of postdoctoral work to go to Stanford. And then in 1984, I did a postdoctoral thing in Lyon, France, at the University of Lyon. And between that times, I taught at USD in the English department. I taught all the courses. I was a director of the graduate program for quite a while. And at the end of my tour of duty in at USD, I chaired the modern language department for 4 years. Retired, kicked around for a few years, went to work for Dan O'Brien, who's an old friend of mine from 1971, and managed his Buffalo Ranch for 10 years. We did a lot of really good things with the environment and Buffalo and reconstituting the wilderness areas and things like that that we worked with on the ranch. I left there and moved to Hill City, and that's where I am. So
let's go back to the University of South Dakota in the late 60s, early 70s. What's the climate like there regarding what's happening in Vietnam?
It was pretty stable. The faculty in many respects didn't think that the students from at USD really had what it took to become involved in that, and the university didn't want to be involved with the Vietnam War except in the sense of being a little bit hawkish. And I got to admit that when I was an undergraduate, I started getting involved in the civil rights thing in Oklahoma, in southwestern Oklahoma, where I lived, and the University of Oklahoma, but still had been reticent to take on any kind of a role in opposition to what was going on in Vietnam. I was still kind of linked into the Viet Minh defeat of the French at Bien Dien Phu, and hadn't really learned about European and Western colonization of Asia and Africa, and I knew about it, but it really didn't make any sense. Gold, diamonds, and orchids, you know, exploit the country. And then when I grew up as a kid, we had all those movies about the values of logging the country, of coal mining, of everything, which was exploiting the natural world in a massive way. So you could see clear-cut forest, you know, and people, the loggers floating logs down the river. And that's the way I grew up, in watching the machines eat into the coal mines. And it didn't dawn on me, it didn't dawn on anybody at that time, that this might not be the best way to go, that untrammeled exploitation of the natural resources that we have is just, it was justified kind of speciously in many respects, but that's what happened, and that's the way it was. So we were really, really, really naive. We didn't know what this world was coming to and what we were bringing it to. And so the defeat of the French at Bien Dien Phu in 54 was just another thing that later on in graduate school I learned about the decolonization of Africa, and I met, in some of my postdoctoral studies, I met people who had been involved in the decolonization, even studying or teaching at USD. I was being confronted often with the best students in the world were not the kids coming out of high school. The best students in the classes at that time were two groups, single parent moms and returning vets.
Really?
And they didn't give anybody any slack. And if you were a professor in front of those classes, you had to be on the top of your game or you wouldn't last. So, I mean, those women were
they
killers.
They wanted their
education. Stone cold killers. But they had lost husbands in the war. They had been divorced. They had been betrayed by whatever it was that had betrayed them. And they were coming back to, and you know, it was going to be, I'm doing this on my own, and by God, I've got the strength to do it, and I will do it. And so that's where you, when you were in front of that class, that's where you were at.
At what point did you decide that what was happening in Vietnam was something that you wanted to speak out about, and how did you so?
There were protests while I was a graduate student at Ohio University, and at that time I was still kind of hawkish, former Marine. And then I came to work at USD and woke up one morning to the tune of the shooting at Kent State. And the claims there that people had been under sniper fire, the National Guard had been under sniper fire, that's simply not true. If there had been snipers on the walls there, there had been people laying on the ground wearing National Guard uniforms, and they simply weren't. There were no snipers there. But later on, I watched the video of that shooting, and those troops came up there and the thing, and the M1 rifle, this is really important, because the M1 rifle was my weapon of choice as an infantryman. It's what I was issued, and I loved it, still do. The safety on the M1 rifle is a little lever that sticks through the center of the trigger guard. So you have your hand on the rifle. If you're holding the rifle like this, you flick your finger forward and the safety goes off. You can hear it in that video, click, 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 click. And then the firing started. Now, according to Ohio law, it was illegal to be on campus with a loaded firearm. So the people, the National Guard, when they got out of their trucks and came on, they had already put their clip of eight rounds in their rifle. They shut the bolt on it, put the safety, locked and loaded. And nobody's ever mentioned, really, probably this is the first time I get a chance to mention in public that you can hear the safety being clicked off, which means that the rifle was already loaded. When I heard that and I saw that, you know, there was no question for me. I'm no longer on that side. I'm shifted. That morning, I got up, I put a black armband of mourning on my shirt, and I walked to the campus. And that day at before noon, there was a rally outside the student union, and I took a 3.5-minute talk about self-defense at that time, and somebody in the audience took a picture of me, and that picture showed up in Kedrick Cummins' history, and everybody thought, not everybody, but a few people thought that the armband, black armband, they didn't see it as mourning for the victims of Kent State. They saw it as a Nazi banner. And my father had fought the Nazis, and I was absolutely anti-Nazi. I still am. I'm anti-Klan. I'm anti-Nazi. I have been for all my life. And so that was a complete misunderstanding, but it didn't change me. I'm there. The picture is in the book, in Kedrick Cummins' first volume of the history of University of South Dakota. And there I am, standing there giving my speech to the people. Like everybody else in those days, I had on a pair of boots and a pair of jeans, or I think I had a tie, a narrow tie that everybody wore, and a white shirt, and and suit pants and a pair of boots, and all of a sudden I'm a Nazi, and they were wrong. Well, anyway, then you go on and on and on and on and on about that, and that speech lasted 3.5 minutes, and there was a then. If you don't mind, I'm just going to tell this. There was an emergency faculty meeting that afternoon. So I had a class to go to. I gave my 3.5 minute speech, and I went to class. I did that all the way through the Vietnam War. I didn't call off classes. I didn't meet out on the sidewalk or out in the street or on the lawn, you know. And so I tried not to let ever my protest interfere with my classes. I had a contract with the Regents. I absolutely respected that. And I was obligated to the students. So that afternoon in the class, and I don't know that anybody ever, Steve Dill, who is dead now, is one of my heroes. I was sitting in the auditorium in the building. It was the science building, I believe, biology building, something like that over there. And this guy about 4 or 5 rows ahead of me turned around and he pointed at me and he said, "That man should be shot." This is faculty. I'm saying, oh, you know, oh. And so he got pretty outstanding. And of course, at that time, I hadn't quite put that old rifleman to sleep. So I hadn't put that old guy to bed yet, you know. It's still waking up in there. And so I said, well, there's the street, you know. Steve Dill stood up, Professor Steve Dill, said, "This man has a right to speak his mind. This is a country of free speech." And that pretty well handled it. Well, when we were being dismissed from the meeting, I walked outside. The guy looked at me and walked the other way. And okay, that's fine with me, because I don't want to get in trouble with the university any more than I'm already in trouble. They already think I'm a Nazi. So, and incredible. So I'm doing my little song and dance down the sidewalk, you know. I think I was back at the university sometime after I retired, and one of the old-time professors, I mean, he was probably older time than me, he came up to me and said, "Jervis, I owe you an apology." "For what?" "All those years, I thought you were on the other side. I thought you were wrong. And I find out that you're not." And I thought, thank you very much. I will accept that apology, because I will accept that apology. You bet.
What'd that mean to you, to have an apology at that time?
Well, it meant that somebody had actually paid attention, even though it didn't come about for years. But that's the way education works. Education doesn't come by in the moment of the classroom. Education comes by when somebody says, "Oh my God, that's what he was talking about." And it might happen anytime. I have a whole collection of letters and postcards and emails of people from years before that said, "I want to thank you for what you did." Well, so I started anyway, and that got me off the track. But I come back to Vietnam, so I started being involved in anti-war things. I never was in the peace-love movement, but I was definitely, I would make readings, poetry readings, and talks, and go to rallies and sit-ins and things like that, and protest marches in the streets in Vermilion or sometimes other places. I was in a major one at Stanford University, which scared the hell out of me.
Do you see the legacy of that time in South Dakota today Can you speak to really how it changed you as a person all these years later? And as you look around and have conversations with people in the state, did it change the character of the state?
Boy, that's a tough question. What grew out of the legacy of the Vietnam War from my perspective, because all of the things like the communes and all of that, what that introduced was things that like recycling. It introduced things like organic gardening, which now has become incorporated into our everyday culture. But at the same time, what we lost out of this was that all those groups, like the Women's Lib and then the Civil Rights Movement and Equal Rights Movement and all the rest, and even the military and the opposition to it, even the RADs, Symbionese Liberation Army and all of that, the whole thing, the Black Panthers. Black Panthers were really important, I thought, and not so much anymore, maybe, but they still have a pretty good voice. Angela Davis was right on with what she was doing. I read all those things. I taught Black Lit for years at USD, introduced it. That was my Stanford work, was to be able to deal with a cultural diversity once I got back to the campus, so that's what I did. And yeah, that kind of thing really changed me. I learned how to be appropriate with talking to and with women, how to act, you know, instead of being a macho ex-Marine infantryman, all of a sudden I've become a little bit human. And what I learned about being human had to do with the concept of respect. You respect even your enemy. That in when we have enemies, we tend to try to objectify them by calling them names, to dehumanize them in some way or another. And I said to myself, and I said to my men, no, we do not dehumanize these people. We have to respect them even though they're an enemy and we might have to do bad things to them. But if you disrespect something like that, what you're doing is damaging the humanity of yourself. And if you disrespect those folks, whoever they are, by giving them names or desensitizing them or dehumanizing them somehow, if you disrespect those people, you have shortchanged something of the value of your own life. And when you can reject that notion of calling the enemy a name or trying to overwhelm the sense of equality between men and women and or racial diversity, cultural diversity, when you don't respect that, you've lost something of your own humanity.
Jervis Hiddle, we're going to have to stop there in the interest of time, but I hope you'll come back and talk to us more in the future. It has been an honor to hear just a fraction of those stories.
Well, I really appreciate having been here, and you have my number.
Thank you. You'll be back. South Dakota Public Broadcasting is in Rosebud tomorrow with a special screening of the Vietnam War. That's at the Rosebud Sioux Veterans Affairs Program Building on August 29th. Meet us in Watertown at the American Legion. Find more South Dakota Vietnam stories on our website, sdpb.org/Vietnam.